We already touched a little bit on to deglobalization and globalization as the key topic. And here we've got Professor Hans-Joachim Voss, who's the scientific director for the UBS Center for Economics in Society. And he will be discussing, the view that, we are entering a time of deglobalization, that the coronavirus and before that, the US-China trade conflict were signs of something bigger. And Hugh Van Steenis, who is the senior advisor to the CEO here at UBS and the chair of the Sustainable Finance Committee, he'll be representing the view that, in fact, Thomas Friedman was correct, that the world is flat and that the forces of deglobalization are perhaps undergoing a bit of a bump at the moment, but that the general trend is somewhat inevitable.
Let me start off by saying what I think globalization is. Globalization means the exchange of people, capital, and trade across borders. And we've seen a tremendous increase in globalization in the period since 1950. Its high point never reached the previous high point of the 19th century, but up to 2008, 2010, most of these variables were going only one way, and that was up. Now, I think that that period has come to an end, that for sure we're not going to see continued increases on the same scale, and I think we're even going to see a decline in the level of all these cross-border variables appropriately scaled going forward. Now, why do I say that? I don't just say that because of Corona. Corona is going to accelerate these things, but I think there's a number of underlying factors that we've seen evolving in the last 10 years that have already put a spanner in the works of globalization, and this will only get worse, partly because of Corona, but also because of other factors. So let me walk you through these different factors as I see them. So the first thing that we've seen is that partly globalization is not going to carry on at the same rate because of its success. Millions and hundreds of millions of people in very poor countries have taken a first step out of primal poverty, especially in China, but also in other countries. Why? Because they used to earn almost nothing. We set up factories there producing low-end textiles, etc. And as these countries had more to sell on the international marketplace, their labor costs have risen. So a large part of the initially gigantic savings that people used to be able to reap by moving factories to poor countries has disappeared. The force that's interacting with that is increasing automation. It's become much easier to do a lot of the stuff back here in developed countries. You can't do it in developing countries because the infrastructure is not good enough. But with robots and computers, we can do a huge part of what we used to use cheap labor in the third world right here at home. The other thing that we've seen is regulation, for example, tax arbitrage, which saw people moving the location of their companies and cash flows around the globe in a very easygoing manner. That is coming to an end. The OECD is putting very effective stops to that. So we're going to see a decline in the extent of regulatory arbitrage and free-footed companies moving wherever they like. And most important, and that's a result partly of the world becoming a more conflict-driven and more ugly place, politics is going to put a huge stop to other factors driving that drove up globalization. Migration will not carry on the same scale. The message is very clear in country after country, including those that we thought were immune to the populist virus. Populists are on the rise, and this one thing that bugs them all is immigration from countries that are culturally different. And if we don't want our countries to implode, we have to find ways to stop the very large migratory flows that we've seen in the last 20 years. On top of that, we've now discovered that it's not just defense where we have to source things locally. Right? Nobody in his right mind would think that we should buy tanks from China because they're cheaper. And in this category of absolutely primary objective, super important stuff that we don't want to rely on anybody else, not even European partners, on to send them to us, we will now find things like ventilators, masks, basic medicine, and a huge share of the stuff that we think was a great idea to produce at the other end of the world. Until now, we will start producing right at home through reshoring, through an end of tax arbitrage, and by treating lots of things as almost as holy as defense.
First of all, thank you. I'm going to turn over to you now, Hugh. So technology, security, politics, you know, pretty powerful forces. You know, how can globalization reassert itself?
I want to argue that whilst the dynamics of globalization are shifting, deglobalization is not really the right way to describe it. And in particular, whilst we might see a further deglobalization of manufactured goods, I expect there'll be an acceleration of the globalization of technology and of financial services. Now, deglobalization is not really a new theme. We've seen global trade to GDP having peaked in 2008, 26%, and continuing to adjust down. Obviously, the trends that Hans Joachim talked about economic nationalism, are important. But I suspect that there will continue, and there will also be a continued shift back of some areas like paracetamol, PPE, and various other manufacturing sectors. But I think there are two really key areas where there might be an acceleration in globalization. One is around technology. What we've seen in this crisis is that the automation and the digitalization of businesses may well accelerate. Take cloud computing. This crisis has highlighted what a critical infrastructure this is. And really, it's just a five-horse race. Amazon, Google, Microsoft, IBM, and Alibaba represent two-thirds of the entire cloud compute back office. And it really speaks to this other theme, which a number of you on the call have thought about, is obviously about winner takes most. In this environment where data is your advantage, these very large cloud computing companies have an extraordinary edge, and you're simply compelled to use them. And so I actually see there's going to be a big acceleration in this. But it's not just cloud computing. Think about how much the Americans tried to stop Europeans using Huawei, and nonetheless, the Europeans continue to use it. This was a big topic when I was working for Mark Carney about the national security of the infrastructure. And maybe that means that some Europeans may not use the Chinese providers, but they're certainly using the US providers. And so I think there is a very profound and deep acceleration around the technology beast. And let's be clear, US and China are the superpowers. They are so far ahead, it's very difficult for anyone else to leverage, both as individual companies, but also as markets. And I think that'll continue. It's not just in cloud computing, take payments as well. We're seeing a very sharp acceleration in the use of cashless payments. 31 countries have raised their contactless limits. The acceleration offline is there. So whilst overall payment volumes are down for obvious reasons, the percentage being done online is accelerating. So what does that mean potentially for megatrends? I mean, first is it may be that R&D rather than cheap labor is what's going to define economic advantage, and smaller firms and smaller countries are going to be utterly dependent on the big techs of the large markets. And that will mean they are still hemmed into globalization, even if they don't like it. And this is pretty profound for markets. Take Microsoft. As of last night, it has a larger market cap than the entire FTSE 100. The value of Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Amex, and if we included Ant Financial as a private company, are tremendous in terms of value. And I think the network effects of these large techs actually should not be underestimated. The other aspect, and it links to what a number of our speakers, you know, from Karen onwards mentioned this morning, is about financial globalization. So once again, as Hans Joachim said, you know, the peak of bank-led cross-border financial globalization was actually in 2008. Cross-border financial flows from banks have fallen by two-thirds since the peak of the crisis in 2008. However, what hasn't changed is that the shift, as the banks got better regulated, as they got balkanized, as regulators trapped more capital, it's the risk has moved to the financial markets, and in particular, the central banking markets. And I think it's fascinating that basically central banks this time had to step in, not to save banks, but actually to save liquidity of bond funds and the liquidity more broadly. So I think there are two key issues to debate from an investment point of view, one of which is the implication of QE infinity, which is one of the likely outcomes from this public health crisis. Central bank liquidity is global and it's fungible. And, you know, the monetary impulse from the G4 central banks has been one of the best predictors of market performance. In effect, it's basically Japanese QE was propping up the US equity and credit markets. And as we get into further and further levels of QE infinity, we should not underestimate how much this liquidity will flow around the market, and in particular at the moment, is supporting the US markets. That may not always be the US, but I think we shouldn't underestimate how globalized central bank liquidity is and the transmission mechanism, and that has far more spillovers than the central bankers would like to have. And then the second is just the primacy of the dollar. Just like in the financial crisis, it was those French structured credit funds in the summer of 07 which gave the canary in the coal mine for the crisis ahead. Actually, it was the dollar funding of supply chains in Asia which was the canary in the coal mine for this crisis. And it was basically the payments chain is the flip side of globalization and was very tight, and therefore the banks started to hoard dollars as they worried they weren't going to get paid, or a minimum get paid late. And I picked up certainly in January already from the Asian treasurers how worried they were. Now, what's been interesting about this crisis is the Fed not only has propped up capital markets, but also reintroduced swap lines very quickly, but also added swap lines for a much wider range of emerging markets. And by acting responsibly, they've probably further weaponized and cemented the role of the dollar as the functional currency of trade, which again will reinforce. So, you know, bottom line, there are lots of cross currents here. And I'm not going to say that there isn't going to be a degree of deglobalization of manufactured goods, but I think we shouldn't underestimate equally the potential for acceleration of globalization of technology and of financial flows.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.